and good afternoon. Welcome back to your extended news at noon. Tracy Morgan, of course, in with you. And we are joined by Dr. Love, Dr. John Love, infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. And we are going to have another conversation about COVID. What I wanted to do today, though, is, in a sense, have Dr. Love just be a doctor. We never really went down that road that we asked him the medical aspect of what does this do within a cell, like at a cellular level in our bodies, what is this doing? So we're going to go through that with him, also kind of get an update on what he is seeing at the hospital, Butler Memorial Hospital at this point. So we're also going to bring up the topic of ivermectin. I know if folks have not heard the stories of people taking this particular, what's typically used as a horse dewormer, then we're going to address that conversation as well. All right. So with us is Dr. Love. Dr. Love, as always, thank you very much for your time. We do appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks.
All right. So let's first off talk about what you're seeing at the hospital, because now we are back to school, but yet I know people have told me personally that they've had elderly family members, you know, now getting this, even though they were vaccinated. So what are you seeing at the hospital?
We are seeing our highest admission rates with COVID and our highest number of inpatients with COVID since we saw last winter when we had our peak. This morning we have, I want to say around 23, 24 inpatients at Butler Memorial with COVID infections. There are a couple other patients on top of that who have been here long enough that they're here for complications of their COVID, but they're out of their precautions, and so we don't count them anymore. On top of that, we have other patients who have been exposed at various points, and they're in isolation because of that. We are really starting to see the volume of these patients starting to strain our health system, not unlike a lot of other places. We are seeing that we're starting to see what this does to our staffing, because this infection is rampant in our community. We have staff who are out sick, which reduces the number of people that we have to care for patients just in general. So not just taking care of COVID patients, but taking care of the run-of-the-mill garden variety, you know, BMH patients that are still coming through. You know, we're really facing all of these strains just on our resources. And on top of that, frankly, you know, our staff is dealing with just the exhaustion of dealing with another surge of this infection that, frankly, a lot of us consider is largely preventable if people had been vaccinated.
We can't stress that enough. You and I have stressed that quite a bit through our conversations, that you need to get vaccinated. Would that be the answer to this problem?
It is going to be the largest part of the answer to the problem. It is the most accessible answer to this problem that we have. Immediately, everyone knee-jerks and says, well, you already said the vaccine is not going to prevent every infection. You're absolutely right. And it was never going to prevent every infection. It may not even prevent every hospitalization. But the data does say that this vaccine, even if it's not preventing every infection, is still very good at preventing hospitalization and death. And if we can keep people out of the hospitals, we can keep caring for people with everything else, their strokes, their broken hips, their heart attacks, and not have this impacting their care. Are we still going to have sick staff members? Yeah, probably, because we all live in the community. But we can work around that if we don't have, on top of our usual patient volume, an extra 25, 30 COVID patients. If it's 5, we can manage that without blinking an eye. But this is a lot of people to care for on top of our usual. And the vaccine is our best, most effective way at reducing hospitalization rates. And this is borne out internationally with countries that have experienced their Delta waves ahead of us. You know, they may still have a bunch of cases, but the death and hospitalization rates are lower when the vaccinated.
So I'm going to repeat what I heard you say, what I've heard you say many times. Of course, if I misspeak, please correct me. But again, I don't think we're talking about it enough, that the purpose of this vaccine is so you don't get into the hospital, ICU, potential death. You may still get COVID-19, but it's to reduce the severe symptoms that one would have with COVID-19. And I say that because I was just in a conversation yesterday trying to relay that information. And of course, I have the great advantage and the honor to talk to you so many times because, of course, the question came up, where did you get that information? I'm like, from the infectious disease specialist at the hospital, straight from him. Then the conversation rolled into, if you have a vaccine where you still could get sick, And how does that compare to vaccines like for polio that we don't see anymore? There are so many other diseases out there, like, you know, mumps, strep, rubella, measles. They're still prevalent in our society. It's just that we kind of live alongside those now instead of have mitigation efforts for those. Can you address that?
You know, the vaccine that probably mimics this the most is influenza. And, you know, our messaging around influenza is actually very similar to this, which is, listen, it may not keep you from getting flu, but it increases your chances of not becoming horribly ill or dying from flu. So it's still, these vaccines still prevent a good number of cases. So don't mishear me that that's the only thing they're good for is preventing hospitalization and death. That's not the message. But people have just decided that if it's not perfect, they won't bother with it, as opposed to everything else in their lives, that they're willing to accept something that's not perfect because it's convenient. Basically, this is just people looking for excuses not to take the vaccine. That's it. Yeah. You want to talk about perfection? Sure. Nothing's perfect. You know what? Polio has been largely eradicated because a global vaccination effort. It's not eradicated. There's still parts of the world where it is occasionally rears its head. But this is also the first vaccine. This virus was novel as of 18 months ago. And we have a vaccine that is this effective, this safe, and I will say that again, this safe, and yet people are still just sticking their heads in the sand like ostriches. They just don't even want to see the data for this. So I don't know what else to say, Tracy. This tool is there. People choose not to use it, and they're just basically shifting their lack of their own personal responsibility onto their healthcare workers, onto their family, onto their coworkers, onto people they're putting at risk. And that's the ramifications of the decisions that they're making.
I was going to wait for the ivermectin part of this conversation, but let me just bring it in now, because when you're talking about people not wanting to see data with a vaccine for COVID-19, there have been many reports that we've seen nationally. I'm not saying locally, I don't have that particular data, but people are taking what's called ivermectin. I know you're familiar with it. I know it because I used to own a horse, and that was typically used as, and still is, used as a horse dewormer. My question to you is ivermectin ever used in human beings? And then your reaction to why people are taking this for COVID-19.
Ivermectin is a great drug in humans for certain parasitic and worm infections. So I love to prescribe ivermectin for Strongyloides. It's a great drug for that. I love to prescribe ivermectin for disseminated scabies because it is more effective than trying to put a cream all over someone's skin. It's great for that. The use of ivermectin as a COVID medication goes way back. And frankly, this kind of falls in the same category as Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine or azithromycin, where there were some in vitro studies that said maybe there was some activity at preventing viral replication in a test tube, you know, with human cells, which is great. That's a great place to start. And then there were some small studies that said, you know, maybe this is effective at preventing or treating COVID with a handful of patients in the study. Okay, terrific. And so then we go to a gold standard, which is a placebo-controlled trial with, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people, and the data is not reproducing, meaning when we look at it in the most thorough and the most scientifically grounded way, we don't see any signs of efficacy. And so that's why the CDC, the Food and Drug Administration, the Infectious Disease Society of America, none of them recommend using ivermectin as a prophylaxis or as a treatment for COVID. The Infectious Disease Society of America has actually come out against using it in any context. I think people are reaching for this because it's been propagated in social media as, your doctor won't tell you this, but not nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And I wish this medicine worked. I said the same thing about Plaquenil. I wish this worked. I wish this was the cure-all that everyone seems to think it is. That would be awesome. It's cheap. The toxicity profile is manageable. That would be terrific. I would love that. But it just doesn't pan out that way. And people are seem to be using it as a substitute for vaccination. I'll just take the deworming medicine if I get exposed. A, even if it worked that way, you don't know when you're exposed half the time. Okay, you're just going to stay on ivermectin perpetually. That's when you run into toxicity issues. B, it's just, again, it's back to just people looking for any reason or any alternative to not take the vaccine. And that's the bottom line. And, you know, now with full FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine, this vaccine has stood up to rigorous review and repeated review. And people would rather take a horse pill that has shown no benefit over a vaccine. And this is just purely from their own prejudices and biases. And that's the bottom line.
Dr. John Love, of course, infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. And Dr. Love, over the many months that we've talked, I've always said, hey, can you tell me this in layman's terms? Help me understand this because I'm not a doctor. I'm not in your shoes. Today, I want you to be that doctor. Can you help us understand COVID-19? I think all of us have seen some picture of the spike protein on whatever given platform that we're viewing. Can you explain that spike protein? Can you explain the receptors and how it attaches to healthy cells?
The way I kind of think about it is you're the virus, you're the COVID virus, and your hand is the spike protein, and you're going to open a doorknob, okay? And the doorknob is your entry into the human cell. The spike protein is your hand. And so the spike protein specifically interacts with a protein on the host cell. This has evolved so that the viral spike protein has this very specific interaction with this one human receptor protein. Okay. It's a very strong interaction, and that leads to basically entry of the viral particle into the host cell, where the virus then starts to replicate and can move on to infect more cells. This is kind of the, I don't want to say the Achilles heel, but a potential point of attack for blocking the interaction of the virus with the cell. If we block the interaction of that spike protein with that cell receptor, say we put up a box over the doorknob, or, you know, more accurately, we put big bulky gloves over your hands trying to, you know, open this doorknob. We can interfere with that interaction and that viral entry point. And that's why the spike protein is really, at this point, the centerpiece of a lot of our therapeutics for COVID. All the currently available vaccines all generate immunity against the spike protein. Because the goal here is to generate antibodies, in part, to generate antibodies that will bind to the spike protein and then prevent it from being able to interact with that host receptor protein, and thereby kind of block, you know,
that
entry point.
Yeah.
So if they don't see each other, that virus can't get into the cell, and you're kind of aborting that whole process.
So that's what the vaccine is doing. The vaccine is putting up that wall.
Yeah. So the vaccine, you know, the goal is basically, you know, to get antibodies that would recognize that viral particle. Now, as the virus replicates in a cell, it's starting to put those viral proteins, that spike protein, on the outside of the cell for this, so the virus can kind of, you know, release from the cell with those on its surface. Okay. And so then there are other cells of the immune system that could recognize that spike protein on the cellular surface itself and then destroy that cell to prevent, you know, ongoing viral replication. So it's multifaceted, but if we can prevent that interaction of that viral particle with the cell to start with, we're really interrupting that cycle. So the vaccines work at that level. Also, what works at that level are these so-called monoclonal antibody treatments, okay? So I know these have been in the news a lot, and we've gotten a lot of questions about them, and these are drugs like the Regeneron cocktail. And the goal with this is, instead of having your body generate antibodies with a vaccination, you're getting infused with basically artificial antibodies that recognize the spike protein. Okay. And so we're giving you what's called passive immunity in the attempt to try to block the viral entry into your cells. That's why the monoclonals act as kind of a substitution. They only are antibodies, so they're not giving you that cellular immunity like we like, and there's no memory to it, meaning those antibodies, they have a half-life of a couple weeks in your blood, and so, you know, once they're gone, they're gone. You don't have any immune system memory, so that if you see the virus again, you're protected. But, you know, they can be helpful in certain situations, but again, they're also still directed at this spike protein. So this is why you hear a lot of concern or just the virologists and immunologists and, public health folks see that, a lot of what we're doing is looking at the spike protein, is targeting the spike protein. But some of the variants are starting to make changes in their spike protein. And Delta has a couple of changes. They don't seem to impact to a great degree the immunity from vaccination or the response to these monoclonal treatments. But will subsequent variants or mutants have more changes in the spike protein so that it won't be recognized by these kinds of antibodies?
Let me ask you a question. When you talk about Delta and you're talking about the spike protein, are those spikes more powerful, or is there more spike proteins or more connection going on between the cells and the receptors, if you will, with the Delta variant? Why is the Delta variant stronger?
I think we're still figuring that out. I think some modeling suggested that some of these amino acid substitutions in the Delta spike protein may increase the affinity for the host cell receptor, meaning, they bind to it tighter, they're basically stickier to it. They don't roll off of it easily. There were some early concerns that some of these substitutions or mutations would make antibodies less sticky to them. The antibodies wouldn't recognize these spike proteins as much. That doesn't seem to be the case. What we do think, we've learned from Delta, though, is that Delta seems to replicate at higher levels. And so the amount of virus that someone carries in their respiratory tract is higher than with the original strain. So they're more contagious just because of the number of viral particles they're able to shed. That is probably unrelated to the spike protein proper. But again, I think we're still figuring out the, molecular microbiology of all of this. And again, this is all happening in real time. So what I tell you today, next week we may have a better answer, or what I said may be proven to be inaccurate or incomplete. I apologize. That's just the nature of trying to practice medicine and science actively during a pandemic.
Right. And I wouldn't apologize, because that is your life. That is science. And you've said that many times before. Science rolls along in real time and it will change. So I wouldn't apologize at all. Let me ask you your response to some folks that I've run into where they say, well, I have healthy cells because I eat right. I've taken my supplements. They exercise. I mean, they do everything that they feel is right. Eating organic, all of it. So they'll say, well, I have a healthy system. What's your response to that? Does COVID not care?
No, it doesn't. You have a healthy system. That's terrific. I'm glad you think that. That may or may not really be true. Eating organic, I don't think that makes any difference with this. The virus doesn't care. These kids that are getting more and more, increasingly numbers are getting sick and critically ill from COVID. These are young, healthy kids. I in no way, I think I'm 47 now. I'm going to say that I'm as young and healthy, that I'm as healthy as, a 16 or 18 year old probably. And yet, they're getting pretty sick. So, again, it's an excuse.
Meaning an excuse from those who don't want to get the vaccine.
They can make all these excuses they want. It's really to help them sleep at night. This virus will find you.
Let me ask you about the demographic, because I know that's what's on people's minds, especially because we are back to school. And I won't ask you what area anybody is from. Of course, we want to make sure that privacy is in play here. But are you seeing younger people? Are you seeing teenagers come into the hospital? Or are you still seeing an older demographic coming into the hospital and in the ICU beds?
We haven't seen a lot of children here to date. As schools open up, we'll see what happens. A lot of our seriously ill children would probably be transferred down to Pittsburgh Children's, assuming they have beds. What you're hearing from other parts of the country is, lack of ICU care beds available to children. We don't normally need a lot of, as a society, don't need a lot of children pediatric ICU beds because they're just not frequently critically ill. But we have to be ready for the contingency. We are definitely seeing younger people. We are seeing people in their 40s being hospitalized. We've had multiple deaths in the 40s, in people in their 40s and 50s. All unvaccinated. So this is, the demographics are changing. Now, Is that because the virus is different and because of the Delta variant? Is that because our older population is more thoroughly vaccinated? So it's the younger people that this is running through because it can? That's possible. Regardless, the end answer to either of those options is get vaccinated.
Is there any word
on... I would just keep encouraging that.
Yeah, is there any word on the vaccines waning from our system? I know we've kind of addressed that throughout the year and a half, and again, reminding everybody that science happens in real time and it can change. Has the medical field discovered that maybe those folks in the beginning who got their vaccinations right out of the gate, are those vaccines waning at all, or are they still pretty protected?
I think there is a growing amount of data coming from elsewhere in the world that there is a waning with the immunity, especially with the vaccine series that we used here in the U.S., the first and second doses being relatively close together at 3 or 4 weeks. And, there does seem to be, at by 6 to 8 months, starting to see a drop off in antibody levels and, more importantly, seeing, an increase in susceptibility to reinfection, or to infection, I should say. And so I think that's where this discussion around a booster dose is coming in. Now, I know everyone's been asking, when can I get my booster? This is still going through the regulatory gears at both the CDC and the FDA. Federal administration has given a target of starting these by September 20th, but that's all pending, the regulatory part. We can't start giving them until we have the authorization to give them. We're still vaccinating people who want to start their series. We are giving third doses to immunocompromised patients. And that's a separate stream, that's a separate process, separate reasoning. These are people whose immune systems don't respond well, with vaccination, don't develop enough protection with just two doses. And so they're getting a third dose to get them basically up to where everyone else is. But a true booster, because of waning immunity over time, I think is coming in the very short future, at least for high-risk people like healthcare workers and nursing home residents and potentially people over, say, age 65. We're approaching 8 months since a lot of the healthcare workers got their second doses, which is the time frame that the Biden administration had been targeting. So this is coming, I think. I would be really surprised if it weren't, because I think the data is really suggesting there is something waning here, and whether a booster should be able to turn that around. The data is suggesting it can, but the sooner we start that, the sooner we have more people that are fully protected, and we may see fewer breakthrough infections.
When can we look at COVID-19, like we look at the other diseases we mentioned, like mom's strep, chicken pox, things like that? When do we start to live alongside COVID-19 and not have all the mitigation efforts? Does it come down to numbers? Because again, in another conversation this week that I had, when we were talking about chicken pox, we'll take schools for example, you may have a child or two have chicken pox and they're out for the day, but you don't have the whole entire school affected. You don't have great numbers affected. Mom strep, the same thing. Does this come down to numbers for when we can move into that stage of this?
I think a lot of it comes down to what we're willing to accept as a culture and how much morbidity, how much mortality are we willing to accept from this virus just to be able to go back to quote unquote normal? How many aircraft crashes are we willing to tolerate to fly on vacation? I would say it's pretty close to zero based on, safety standards. How many foodborne infections are we willing to tolerate in our produce? Well, we really try not to tolerate any. We do case contracts. There's handling instructions, things like that. So I think we're going to have to decide where we're comfortable. We shouldn't have 40-some-year-old people dying of a respiratory infection that's vaccine preventable. That's just the bottom line. And yet here we are. The mitigations, I think, are important to bring cases down to a point where I don't think we're ever going to be without this virus, especially if we can't get closer to 100% of the population vaccinated. We're not going to be able to get rid of this. So it's going to become endemic. We're going to have clusters. We're going to have small outbreaks, hopefully not large outbreaks. So I think going forward, we're just going to have to say, listen, some people want to say, I'm fine with Balmoral being, fully full of COVID patients and my cancer treatment being pushed off because they can't do anything else but COVID right now. That's fine. I'd rather have my kid in school than take the vaccine and help them out. That's their decision.
That was the point that I was going to reiterate. Yeah, I mean, you say where we are comfortable, but if it doesn't get under control, again, you have healthcare systems throughout the country that will be short on employees, and that affects us all, just on anything that we need from a hospital or a doctor. So just as a reminder, folks, Butler Hospital, Butler Health System, they have reopened their testing site availability. The hours, as we're talking to Dr. Love today on the 3rd of September, the hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. until 12 noon, closed on holidays. That's a drive-through tent that's located at 304 Delwood Road. And again, patients are going to require a script for the COVID testing. An appointment is not necessary, but you still need that script. So again, as of September 3rd, that's the latest information on the testing. The vaccines are always being offered through the Butler Health System as well as many different other places. So you have plenty of opportunity to get vaccinated. So please do get vaccinated. Dr. John Love, infectious disease specialist with the Butler Health System. As always, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Tracy.